Hello and welcome to the Game Theory Podcast. I'm your host, Sam Vecini. We're presented by The Athletic. Today on the show, Blake Murphy is in the building. Blake and I are going to continue the Game Theory Podcast's off-season recaps with the Atlantic Division. Blake covers the Toronto Raptors for our lovely website, The Athletic. Please go subscribe to The Athletic. Blake, how you doing, man?
I'm doing well. How are you?
I am doing well. You got back from Las Vegas okay? Everything's good?
Yes, sir. You know, the protocol here in Canada is, yeah, test on your way out, test on your way back in, test when you land. So all clear. It's a bit of a pain, but it's really nice to have that, like, at every step of the process. You're like, all right, I'm cool. I'm good for a few more days.
Yeah, I'm safe. I haven't caught the terrible virus or anything yet. How was Summer League for you? Did everything go well?
Yeah, it was cool. It was, you know, I miss the kind of personal element of our jobs a fair amount, you know, even if it's stuff that, you know, certainly I reported a couple things that was just like right place, right time. Like, you know, Isak Bonga walks in the gym with the Raptors and I'm like, did you guys sign him? But there's also like an element of, and you know, this is like a lot of what you get in conversations doesn't end up in an article, right? It informs your opinion. It builds relationships. It puts stuff on your radar for later. And that's an element of the job that the last year and a half or so I've really been missing. And it's a part that I really enjoy. You know, I like being in the gym and watching four or five games in a day and keeping an eye on the G Leaguers and getting excited about, you know, random guy X who, you know, maybe tops out as a good G Leaguer, but you know how that stuff goes better than just about anyone. It's nice to be back in kind of the nitty gritty stuff.
Yeah, I feel like you and I care about that stuff more than just about anyone in the world. So I'm glad that you got a chance to see David Johnson and Delano Banton and get
Banton news,
by the way.
That was exciting. Yeah. Yeah, him getting the full NBA deal because David Johnson and Justin Champagne are on the two ways for the Raptors. So
yeah, how about that?
And Banton getting a full year one guarantee and a year two partial. Nice bit of business.
Yeah, Delano Banton's agents did very, very well by him. Not only did they get the one in a partial guarantee, they also only got him on a 2-year deal, meaning if he's good, then they're going to be able to get him paid. If he's not good, then, you know, it's no hide off of Toronto's back and he'll move on and go elsewhere. But to not have to deal with like the team option process in the third year, like guys, you know, I'm trying to think like Miles McBride, I think, got 2 years guaranteed. And I think that like Herb Jones got 2 years guaranteed. But like they then for that have to deal with the third year team option where it'll be cheap if they are good by year two. So, yeah, I think that the agents for Delano did really, really well to get him that deal.
And
we'll talk about Toronto.
I'll just say I was a little surprised because the Raptors maneuvered in a way where they kept the chunk of their mid-level open. So I was like, oh, that's with the intention of signing one or two of these guys to a 3-year deal, and it remains open. So we'll talk a lot of Toronto, I'm sure, but interesting offseason all around for them.
Yeah, we'll talk about some of my worries about Toronto. Yeah. Very, very weird offseason for them. But as usual, with these offseason recaps, we go in alphabetical order, and Toronto is last, so we'll talk about your team last. Instead, we will start with the Boston Celtics in the Atlantic Division, and the Celtics had a pretty interesting offseason. So it started earlier than everyone else's offseason because they traded Kemba Walker and the number 16 pick to the Oklahoma City Thunder for Al Horford and Moses Brown with some second-round swapping in there, essentially just trying to get off of the long-term Kemba Walker deal for financial reasons and for flexibility reasons. They signed Dennis Schroeder to a 1-year $5.9 million deal. They extended Marcus Smart, actually like 2 days ago, for a 4-year $77 million price tag. They signed Enes Kanter to a minimum deal. They traded for Josh Richardson into the remaining Gordon Hayward trade exception. They acquired Chris Dunn and Bruno Fernando for Tristan Thompson. They drafted Juhan Bagarin out of France, and importantly, which is a thing that just came across my radar, they lost Evan Fournier, but then negotiated a sign and trade with the Knicks that then opened up a $17 million trade exception for them to use over the course of the next year, which is a little bit more valuable for them because they've kind of showcased that they're able and willing to use those trade exceptions in a way that past teams that have had them just don't really use them. So, overall, what was your thought on the way that the Celtics handled the offseason?
Yeah, unfortunately, I think they got better. That's a, you know, it's a, there's a little bit of a friendly rivalry between Raptors Twitter and Celtics Twitter, and maybe there was some kind of camaraderie in the shared misery both teams faced last year. But, you know, as the Atlantic division returns to health, and I think it's, you know, we'll go through these teams, it's a pretty strong division. The Vegas win totals certainly think that it's a strong division. So you don't, you know, Raptors fans don't want to see Boston get better, but I think they did. And I think the TPE is interesting, in part, you know, combined with the Marcus Smart extension. That clearly signals what I think a lot of us figured before, or the Smart deal signals, rather, that, you know, if they're going to make a play for a Bradley Beal type, that's going to have to be via trade. There's just not a reasonable path to cap space for them. And then the TPE is helpful in an event that, you know, that next top guy doesn't hit the market and they're looking for something around the trade deadline or next offseason to fortify. Now, we no longer get to make the joke of all the trades the Celtics would have made. We have to give Brad Stevens a blank slate to see if he'll actually pull the trigger on this this nice piece of flexibility. But I think it's fine. You know, I think the Fournier addition was good, and then obviously it went the way it did for circumstances out of pretty much anyone's control. But the pivot from that, and you have Josh Richardson, and you have, you know, Chris Dunn, who I've always been a big fan of, and Enes Kanter, who at worst is a functional bench big. And then Schroeder, you know, there are questions about Schroeder's fit and certain other things about Schroeder in general, but at that price, like, you can't go wrong. Like, that's a surplus value deal almost out of the gate. So I like what they did. They had to pivot off of a couple things that didn't work before, and credit to them for not, you know, digging into the sunk costs there and chasing good money with bad, or bad money with good, however that saying goes. I don't lose money at the table, so I don't I don't know what the saying is. But yeah, I thought it was pretty strong overall.
Yeah, interesting. I liked a lot of what they did. I thought that getting Josh Richardson and Chris Dunn certainly kind of showcased that they are looking to improve the defensive side of the floor. I will be interested to see if Chris Dunn ends up on that roster, to be honest. I'm like not 1,000% sure of that, if only because the price tag here is pretty substantial. Like, they are in the middle of the tax, and there is a really nice Rockets trade exception out there for $5.02 million that, like, perfectly fits Chris Dunn's number, kind of like a glove. And I wonder if the Celtics try to get off of the Chris Dunn money at some point midseason in order to get off of that money. But
damn shame. I've always been such a big Chris Dunn fan, and as a all defense, not quite functional offense guy, he's such a Raptor, and their Lowry trade exception is like $70,000 short after the extra hundred after the $100K extra. Just out of reach.
Just out of reach. That's a little bit rough, but nonetheless, Chris Dunn's like the ninth man on this roster.
Yeah.
Replacing Josh Richardson, or replacing Evan Fournier with Josh Richardson, probably is a downgrade, unfortunately, but it's one that will make them tougher to play against defensively for sure, because Richardson is good. And if they get a bit of a, I think that they're betting on basically a regression in terms of the shot back to what he was midway through his career. The last couple years have been tough in Philadelphia and Dallas, but maybe he can improve a little bit. The Dennis Schroeder deal, like you said, it's fine. I will be interested to see what the Celtics do at point. Our Shams Charania reported that they're planning to start Marcus Smart at point guard, and then they're probably going to go with a bigger lineup. I'll be interested to see if that's like Al Horford at the four and Robert Williams at the five, or do they start like Aaron Naismith at the two? If I was them, like, I would pretty strongly consider going smaller and playing like Jaylen Brown and Jason Tatum down at the three and the four, start Smart at the two, and then start one of Schroeder or Peyton Pritchard at the one. A big part of the reason for that is that Peyton Pritchard has been fucking amazing at Summer League.
Summer League legend, fast PP, flying back in for the championship game because even the Vegas flags fly forever.
He's unreal. What a dude. I think he was the best player I saw at Summer League this year. I wrote that at the site. Just his overall creativity, his ability to shoot, all of it. This is a team that desperately needed offense in the backcourt last year, even with Kemba Walker. And to lose Kemba and then go out and get Dennis Schroeder, hopefully get a bit of a bounce from Peyton Pritchard, add Josh Richardson. I mean, look, this team's probably going to be a little bit worse offensively in the backcourt, if only because losing Kemba Walker and Evan Fournier, you're losing the two best guys out of the group of current Celtics and last year Celtics, right? But at the end of the day, I think they did probably as well as they could have if they were pretty enthused about getting off of that Kemba Walker contract.
For sure. And that, you know, that hamstrings you a little bit. And now, you know, Cantor didn't, you know, break the bank or anything. He got the minimum. But there is a little bit of a, you know, how do the pieces fit with Robert Williams? I thought last year, you know, ready for a bigger role, it looked like at times. And I know some health issue there. And so, yeah, I'm curious to see how the pieces fit. And then, you know, if they go big, where does Grant Williams fit in? Grant Williams is an interesting guy as well. And I think, you know, there's a more obvious path to him seeing playing time if they're a little bigger and he's soaking up some minutes at the four versus if they're a little smaller and things are, I guess he could still see minutes in that kind of, basically I'm curious where Grant Williams fits in all this because there's a lot of minutes or not a lot of minutes to go around for a lot of guys, which is a good problem to have, but you know, you don't want to stifle the growth of guys like Grant Williams and Robert Williams who, you know, probably have some developmental curve left. And, you know, Boston's in a position where, let's be honest, they're a good team and that Brown-Tatum duo is going to put you in the mix for some stuff, but they're not in that top tier of the Eastern Conference yet without some growth from these guys who do have upside left. So how that gets managed will be interesting, I think.
Yeah, it feels like they're going to need one of like Peyton Pritchard, Aaron Naismith, Grant Williams, Robert Williams to make the leap into, I don't want to say like stardom, but at the very least becoming like above average starters. Like right now, I would not say Robert Williams is an above average starter. He's probably the closest out of that group. I really like Pritchard, and I think Aaron Naismith has done some really interesting things the Summer League as well, just looking a little bit more confident playing off the bounce as opposed to last year when he was more of just a catch and shoot guy. So I'm intrigued to see where this team ends up. They are going to need, though, I think, a pretty real bounce from some of these young guys at some point. And it's a little bit unclear if these guys can do that to the level that Boston needs. Until then, they're going to be relying on guys like Dennis Schroeder to kind of stem the tide. And that feels like an okay place to be, given that he'll at least be productive and score and will provide value off the bench. But you know, how much does that move the needle in terms of the Celtics being like a top three team in the East again? I'm not sure. Where would you have the team in the Eastern Conference hierarchy right now?
Yeah, not in the top three. I think they're probably in that mess of 5-8 and probably on the 5-6 side of that, yeah, of that mess. I haven't laid out the entire East, but, you know, I think I'd probably have them, Atlanta, and Toronto in some 5-6-7 order with an eighth in there. But it's, the East gets really tight once you get out of those top four. And even like regular season wise, I don't even know if Miami will be in that top four just because of the age and the way they might manage minutes and stuff like that. But I think like big picture, if we're talking team quality, Miami will kind of be in that top four and Boston might be toward the top of that next tier. Like you said, I just have big questions about how it all fits offensively and if another guy can pop. You look at the way that this offense was structured last year, two guys at 30% usage and then like a bunch of role players when Kemba wasn't healthy. And when Kemba was healthy, you know, that's a third guy up with a really high usage rate. That's a lot of possessions to soak up, and you probably you know, you can lean on Tatum and Brown for 30% usage, and they're both still young with some upside, but you need some variability in your attack there, I think. And as you laid out, I don't know that they, you know, they might have gone the opposite direction on that side of the ball.
Yeah, I'll be interested to see how their offense changes with Ime Udoka taking over as the head coach, mm-hmm. as opposed to Brad Stevens. Does it adjust and become a bit less player-centric, at least maybe a bit less ball-dominant with two guys, with Jaylen Brown and Jason Tatum, or does it become more ball-dominant with those two because they need just creation, and those guys are by far the two best creators on the team. Yeah, I'll be fascinated to see what that looks like. I think I agree with you. I would have this team below Philadelphia and Brooklyn, both below Milwaukee, below the Miami Heat. I think I would probably have them below the Hawks. I think they would be my number six team in the East, along with New York, realistically. So it's a tricky spot for the Boston Celtics right now. They need to kind of navigate where they're going in terms of just what their future looks like, because it feels like this is a team building toward the future, but they do only have Jaylen Brown under contract for, I believe, two more years at this point. It could be three.
It's three for Brown and with the option five for Tatum.
Yeah, I forgot that Jaylen didn't have the player option on the last year of that deal. So they still have 3 years. But this window gets tighter than what you would think for a team that just is very young. Like, Boston is a very young team still, given the fact that, you know, Jaylen Brown, Jason Tatum, Peyton Pritchard, Robert Williams, Grant Williams, Aaron Naismith, all these guys, Romeo Langford, they're all under 25 at the very least. So we'll see how they look. I think Boston got better. It's just how much better, I think, is the realistic question at this point, right?
For sure. And you know, you mentioned the window and the tightening here. And, you know, Smart being under a new deal is really important, because you look at their cap sheet moving forward, and, you know, who knows what they end up doing with Horford next year with the partial. But Richardson's a free agent. Schroeder will be a free agent. Dunn might not be there. Robert Williams is restricted this coming year, so due to get paid. There's going to be a crunch here at some point. And like you said, they need one of those guys to pop, and maybe not become necessarily a number three in like a big three hierarchy, but they need reliable starting depth out of at least one of those guys now and longer term. Because, like, even if you're talking, you know, say Bradley Beal does hit the market and this roster, you know, they consolidate some of these pieces to make a play like that, the cap sheet only gets tighter from there. So you need to hit on these inexpensive guys and get rotation level production out of them while they're still cheap. And I don't love talking about players in like asset terms like that, but when you have a top heavy salary structure, that's how you make it work, and that's how you make it work long term, is to continue to hit on the lower cost side.
Okay, let's move on. Let's talk about the Brooklyn Nets. They had, you know, pretty normal offseason for a contender, I would say. They extended Kevin Durant for 4 years, $196 million. They signed Patty Mills and James Johnson. Johnson to the minimum, Patty Mills to a two-year deal for the taxpayer mid-level exception. They had Bruce Brown accept the qualifying offer, which is a pretty big thing for them. They re-signed Blake Griffin. They signed your legend, DeAndre Bembry. and then had some general, you know, just like kind of cap draft machinations. And yes, they acquired
a million second round picks because they have the lower rookie hold.
Lower
rookie tax hit. Yeah.
So they acquired the number 29 overall pick and Javon Carter for Landry Shamet. They drafted Dayron Sharpe with the number 29 pick. They drafted Cam Thomas, Kessler Edwards, Raekwon Gray, and Marcus Zegarowski as well. That's five rookies that they drafted this year. How many of those guys are actually on the roster? We'll see. I believe that Zegarowski...
By the way, his full name at this point is Summer League leading scorer Cam Thomas.
Oh, he's a bucket. Like, that's what he does.
Tee it up properly. Yeah.
That's what he does.
Slide right into the Mike James role in that second or third unit.
Oh, man. They got involved in the sign-in trade for Spencer Dinwiddie. I believe that they got Nikola Milutinov from the Spurs, who, like, kind of a sneaky get if they could ever get him to come over. He's one of the best centers in Europe. I will be curious to see if he ever has a desire to come over. They lost Jeff Green as well. It's just kind of worth saying. Look, this team is going to be fully dependent upon what, you know, Kyrie Irving and James Harden do next year and how healthy they are. If those two are healthy for 90% of the season and they are healthy in the playoffs, I think this team is the favorite to win the title. If not, we'll see.
Yeah, I mean, and that's a huge if, right? It's all three of those guys dealt with stuff last year. And, you know, this is where I find the Nets fascinating, you know, not just for their tax bill. And, like, hilarious that in the Dinwiddie thing, they create an $11 million and change trade a player exception where it's like, could you really add another piece? And, like, at the point that they're at in the luxury tax, you know, that $11 million salary is exponentially more. But I think they're super interesting. I think they had, like you said, a smart offseason for what a contender has to do. You know, Joe Harris and DeAndre Jordan are probably both not at price tags that you'd like to have with you know, almost 120 million or more than 120 million tied up with three guys. But Joe Harris is also a super valuable guy around these guys. And DeAndre Jordan is their pal, which is as much as you can say about that. But no, I liked it. I think, you know, the second round pick thing makes sense from a cap perspective. You know, I could see Alize Johnson being who is another one of my guys being a victim there, because, you know, he has the higher cap hold and all. DeAndre Bembry was actually a little bit surprising as a landing spot there just for that reason, but another guy who's close with Kyrie and you know, brings the vibes. And him and James Johnson could have like an interesting straight man wild man kind of combination there, with their two personalities having known them a little bit in Toronto. But it's good, man. I think, you know, Bruce Brown at the qualifying offer is probably fine if you're Brooklyn, because while he might get more expensive next year, you know, you don't have to eat the full freight of that or a share freight of that this year. If someone had offer sheeted him, and the Patty Mills addition is just great. You know, like, this is a guy that's an automatic 38-39% three-point shooter, knows how to get his shots around more ball dominant guys. Really, really good from all accounts. Culture guy, which I don't think you can ever underestimate, especially, you know, if you think, hey, we might have some injury issues or you know, there's a lot of pressure that comes with being a team that has James Harden and Kevin Durant and Kyrie Irving, and filling that locker room with guys who have been through it, I think, is a real consideration. So, yeah, I'm fine with the offseason that they had. I think you don't need to do a lot when you've already done the work to get Harden, Durant, and Irving. You just make sure everything's stable. You make sure everything's, you know, stable both in terms of on-court depth and you know, what the environment is like around those guys and in the event of injury, and you pay a ludicrous luxury tax bill, which they're going to do. So, yeah, I mean, I don't feel much differently about Brooklyn now than I did when they put all this stuff together. Like you said, the health is a big question mark with those three guys. But when they're healthy, they are three of the best in their roles in the league. And Kevin Durant, you know, could, despite the Achilles stuff and the kind of bumps and bruises he had this year, you know, he could be back to best player in the world status in his 30s here. Like, if the Olympics were any indication and how he looked when he was healthy last year, there's a lot to like here. They're going to be super fun again.
Yeah, I'll be honest. I think Kevin Durant's the best player in the world. Just yeah, circle like, of trust here. Kevin Durant's the best player in the world right now. Like, yeah.
It's close. There's a couple guys who at any given time, you know, you see one game and it's like, oh, well, maybe that guy is. Or Giannis drops 50 on one leg in the finals. And it's like, oh, maybe that guy is. But then, you know, Kevin Durant is Kevin Durant. And you start seeing these feathery jump shots from a 7-footer go down. And it's like, oh, yeah, he's impossible when he's on. So I'm really looking forward to watching this team and seeing what, you know, if these three guys can get more than 8 or 12 games together, what that could look like.
Yeah, I think this team is deeper than it was in the playoffs last year, or at least it has potential to be. Look,
Are you a Claxton guy?
I am a Nick Claxton guy. I have been. I had him too. Like 20th on my board, 21st on my board pre-draft. Okay. It was always going to be a project, and this was always the year where they were going to have to reap the rewards of Nick Claxton, and I think that they're going to. I think he's going to be really good. It wouldn't surprise me if they extended him at some point.
Yeah, that little bit of playmaking, you know, if you can have a guy who's a non-zero playmaker and who can, you know, functionally operate like that, like I think it's, and we didn't talk about this specifically with Robert Williams, but I think it's something he brings too, especially when you're going to be a lower usage guy around more ball dominant guys, is that that extra little bit of ability to dribble out of DHO, to be a threat, to do something yourself, to pass at a short roll. Like that's, they're kind of simple things in terms of like role definition, but they're things that not a lot of centers who are inexpensive do. So I think he's a really cool player here, and you know, it's funny, last year when everyone's talking about, like, you know, covering the Raptors and they're clearly going the opposite direction and people are talking about trade scenarios, and like every single one, you know, Raptors fans treating him like a second round pick of like, oh, just throw in Nick Claxton. I'm like, excuse me, the Nets are not going to throw in the young functional center they have for $1.7 million. Like, anyway. No.
Yeah, you can't do that.
Trade machine's fun, but
he was very useful for them, I thought, in the playoffs in the limited minutes that he got. Very good rim protector, switchable out on the perimeter. Like you said, can handle, can run some DHOs. At some point, the shooting is going to have to come around. I would like to see that before I get like overly excited. But I think he has a chance to be really good. Like, if you told me he was their best center and their starting center by the end of the year, wouldn't stun me at all. At this point, I think he has a chance to be really, really good. You throw in the fact that they got harder to play against, I think, just defensively on some level, right? Like, they go out and get Javon Carter. DeAndre Bembry is a little bit better, I think, than TLC. And they go out and get James Johnson, who is tough. Blake Griffin played a really tough brand of basketball as the big inside last year for them. I thought De'Ron Sharpe is like a big physical dude inside that they might be able to steal a couple minutes here and there with. And on top of that, they go out and they get Cam Thomas, who we know can go out and get a bucket. If he can't do anything else, and I really don't think he can, he can definitely go get buckets. And that is incredibly important. And by the way, like, Kessler Edwards is a good long-term defender for them to develop as well. So
he had a nasty block on Freddie Gillespie today. Gillespie, like, pump faked the center and thought he had a clear path to a dunk or a layup, and Kessler came out of nowhere and surprised him.
Yeah, like, I feel like this team next year, we're looking at like a playoff closing lineup of something like Kyrie Irving, James Harden, Kevin Durant, probably Blake Griffin is still in there, and then depending on if Bruce Brown is hot or if Patty Mills is rolling, maybe they need like crazy point of attack defense with Javon Carter or something like that, depending on the lineup. There are just a lot of different things I think that they can present to opposing teams. Now, maybe it's Nick Claxton if you need to go super switchable. Like, on top of that, like, I didn't even mention Joe Harris. Joe Harris is definitely in their closing lineup, you would think. So, you know, this team is deeper.
Embarrassment of options here, yeah.
Yeah, they're deeper than they were last year. I probably will bet on them to win the title, if we're being honest.
Yeah. Yeah, and like, a team like this is always like a little hard to figure for regular season, just because, you know, they're obviously going to be ultra cautious with anything with their big three guys, and, you know, with the injury tape those guys have had, you know, you can probably price in all three of them, you know, 70 games is maybe optimistic for each of them. So I don't know that much about like where they finish in the standings and like their 55.5 win total over under. I'd probably still lean over on it, but I don't think that matters to them as much as it's going to matter to, you know, a Philly or something like that, who the margins are going to mean a lot more. Brooklyn's going to trust their guys, and man, they are super, super deadly on paper. It's a lot of fun.
Okay, let's take a quick commercial break, and then we'll be back with the Knicks and Sixers.
Hold up.
let's talk about a different kind of performance than what we're talking about with the NCAA tournament. They want to help your performance in the bedroom. Joy mode, you know, just like on the basketball court, sometimes you might have an off night. Maybe you're playing okay and you want to take your game up a level even. That's where joy mode is going to come in. Don't grab some over-the-counter pills that you see at a gas station. They're going to often contain unregulated chemicals, suggest unsafe doses, carry the risk of several other health problems down the road. That's why we've partnered with Joy Mode. Whether you're looking to spice up your intimate moments or increase your confidence in the bedroom, Joy Mode makes all natural and science-backed supplements dedicated to helping men perform better across their core functions. Their trademark product, the Sexual Performance Booster, is every man's solution for increased performance. It's like a pre-workout, but for sex. And get this, all ingredients have been assessed in peer-reviewed journals and researched in humans. Imagine this, it comes in a palm-sized packet, like your favorite electrolyte powder. Just simply mix it with 6 to 8 ounces of water 45 minutes before sexual activity begins, and you're going to watch the magic unfold. Redefine your intimacy and go to use joymode.com for 20% off with code GAMETHEORY. That's GAMETHEORY. That's 20% off and free shipping with code GAMETHEORY. Not only is this the only supplement you'll need in the bedroom, but it also supports blood vessel support, cardiovascular and heart health, athletic performance, blood pressure, and general erection function. So why settle for anything less? Whether you're happy or unhappy with your performance in the bedroom, why not perform even better with Joy Mode? Okay, we're back. Let's talk about the New York Knicks. They got Julius Randle to sign his 4-year, $117 million extension. They signed Evan Fournier. And a lot of these deals, by the way, we're going to give the full deals here because I think that they look a lot better now that the full details have come out. Evan Fournier, 4 years, $78 million, last year team option. Nerlens Noel, 3 years, $27.8 million, last year team option, not $332 million like was initially reported. Kemba Walker, 2 years, $18 million. Alec Burks, 3 years, $30 million, last year team option. Derrick Rose, 3 years, $43 million, last year team option. They exercised their team option on Mitch Robinson, which was interesting because they could have made him a restricted free agent this year, or they could have rolled it, had him cheap this year, and he now will be an unrestricted free agent next year. Very strange, not a strange choice, but we'll kind of talk about that in the context of the Nerlens Noel decision, which I thought was interesting. They signed Taj Gibson to a 2-year, $10 million deal where the last year was also a team option. Finally, they drafted Quentin Grimes, Miles McBride, Rokas Jakubaitis, and Jericho Sims. Rokas is going to be a stash with Barcelona next year. Miles McBride has signed a 3-year deal for $4.2 million. I believe that the first 2 years of that deal are guaranteed. And Jericho Sims signed a 2-year two-way contract.
Oh,
it's like malpractice level bad.
Was it you that when you came on the draft pod with me, we talked about, I ranted on one of our podcasts about this recently at The Athletic, and the 2-year two-way is not a good deal, and I don't really understand how, like, even a 1-year two-way has such awful RFA rules where the qualifying offer is just another two-way with $50,000 on it, and like there's not a lot of freedom there for players. So to sign a 2-year two-way is I guess it's it's like a backward bet on yourself where it's like, oh, I'm betting that I'd get converted, but it's like also you're giving yourself a 2-year window. I don't know. And like, I like Jericho Sims. I think he's fun. If you ask Knicks fans at Summer League, he's already better than Mitchell Robinson, which is not accurate. But that's weird. I just like, I don't really like the idea of a 2-year two-way, not just for play. Like, I just don't think it's a thing that should exist.
Yeah, I agree. It really hinders like player rights, in my opinion. And by the way,
yeah, and like maybe it's a little better now with the half a minimum, like what is it, 460 or something like that, that guys will get in that spot. But still, it's brutal. I don't love it.
It's brutal. Jericho Sims, by the way, that comes from Spotrack. I have it as a 2-year two-way per Spotrack, which I believe is Keith Smith running that.
It is Keith now, yeah, been, which is great for Keith.
Yeah, Keith's pretty good with this stuff. So the fact that he has it as a 2-year two-way makes me think that it is a 2-year two-way. Brutal. Absolutely brutal by Jericho Sims' representation to do that. Also just worth mentioning, though, that they acquired future first and second rounders with draft day trades, because they moved 19 for Kai Jones. They moved 21 for Keon Johnson to the Clippers. Kai Jones went to the Hornets, and they still got pretty reasonable value at the 19 and 21 spots with the picks that they had. Like, they ended up getting Quentin Grimes, Miles McBride, Rokas Jakubaitis, and Jericho Sims. Like, I had first round grades on McBride and Jakubaitis. I had a top 40, top 35, top 40 grade on Quentin Grimes, and I had a top 50 grade on Jericho Sims. So they did well in the draft, and on top of that, acquired future first and seconds with their kind of draft day maneuvers. Look, I'm as guilty of it as anyone. When I saw the initial reports of what the Knicks did this offseason, I thought it was not great. I think they had a good offseason. I really do. I think that they did a good job of running it back while still maintaining flexibility in 2 years to be able to potentially chase free agents and do what the Knicks try to do every year. And then it also gives them just a 2-year further window of being competent. And this is an organization that just desperately needs a long stretch, not just a 1-year stretch, but a prolonged stretch of competence.
Yeah, and you know, it's not a dissimilar situation from what the Bulls are in, right? Where you're in a marquee market, you want to show these young guys and potential free agents that, like, hey, we've probably moved past where you could just rely on being New York, if that was ever a thing even, to get free agents. You need to be a competent franchise, and you need to get the Knicks back to some level of, well, I'm not joining a completely empty slate. So I'm with you in that regard. I really dislike the Derrick Rose deal. You know, I think that one kind of reeks to me of not necessarily fan service, but like, you optically didn't want to lose Derrick Rose and not have something coming back in to replace that, which is fine. But then, like, who are you negotiating against at that price, kind of? But otherwise, yeah, like, I like their draft. You know, I think they've done a pretty decent job developing the young side. Like it's summer league and he's a second year player, but Obi looked awesome. Which he better at that point, right? Like, that's the test for second year first round picks, is you better look good at summer league. But yeah, it's fine. There's a little bit of, you know, the, like you said, the Robinson Noel thing is a little curious, especially because, you know, you tee up the way that this cap sheet looks in 2 years, maybe, and that pivot foot, and you know, you lose some of that maybe if you give Robinson a big deal. So I don't know. Them picking up the option on him signaled to me that, like, maybe he's not as big a part of their future as I had believed, because I like Robinson and I thought they're pretty invested there. And obviously, there's room for multiple centers in a rotation, but salary wise, I'm not sure where that's going. I have a question for you. Do you like Luca
Vildoza, our Argentine king? No, I mean, like, I don't think he's an NBA player, to be honest, but he's super fun to watch. Like, he's super creative with the ball, has a crazy handle, has, like, the utmost green light confidence in himself. Look, I think they just have too many point guards on this roster, which is funny because, the Knicks, every Knicks fan was like, we need point guard. We need to get a point guard. Well, they now have Emmanuel Quickley. They still have Derrick Rose. They have Kemba Walker now, and they have Miles McBride, who I think is really good. And on top of that, they drafted Rokas Jakubaitis, who is a stash. So, like, I don't see the fit for Vildoza, but, you know.
He also has, like, one of the weirdest, like, his contract is such a relic of the last CBA, not this CBA. Like, it's a Scottie Hobson deal. He got 3 years and almost $10 million. With, like, all these different guarantee triggers and stuff, and almost nothing, like, fully guaranteed. Right. And, like, that's, you know, that was the pre-2017 kind of special, right? Of, like, give a guy a little bit so you can get that big non-guaranteed part, and it's tradable, but they changed the rules on that. So I don't know. It's a funny contract structure to me, and I don't, you know, I don't get to see a ton of the Spanish league, so I was curious about your take on him. Also, the interesting, like, I always just get a kick out of when teams sign guys at the end of the season prior.
Yeah. Just the Gabriel deck special.
Yeah, exactly. That was it sounded like the Raptors almost did that with Ishmael Wainwright, by the way, but he couldn't get out of the Strasbourg deal.
Yeah, we'll talk about Ish Wainwright. I'm kind of curious on Ish. Yeah, the Knicks center position's interesting, which is kind of where this whole thing started, right? Like, you know, that Nerlens Noel deal is essentially a 2-year, $18 million deal. Like, it's listed at, it was initially reported at $332 due to bonuses that are unlikely or considered unlikely within collective bargaining agreement terminology. It ended up being a 3-year, $28 million contract, and then has the team option, so really they're only locked in for him for 2 years, $18 million. I think that if you put it in that context, they could certainly re-sign Mitch Robinson this offseason, and it will be fine, like, depending on what they have to pay him. Like, even if they have to pay him, like, say he breaks out and they have to pay him $18 million this year, like, that's fine. You can live with a year
I'm
where
more
you're
looking
paying
ahead to kind of. Yeah, I'm more looking ahead to kind of 2023 when that pivot foot is there and RJ's do a new deal, and that's kind of where my head was at with that. I know Noel's not really a factor there because it's a team option that year, but the sheet still gets a little
cluttered. Yeah.
But that's, I mean, hey, it's the NBA. Every contract is tradable. You can always find a home for guys, and it's like it's not like Nerlens Noel at 2 years, 18 wouldn't be extremely movable if they needed it at some point, or you know, so I don't want to get too bogged down with that, but I think there's a solid team here. I don't know if they're a 10 games over 500 team. I think that was maybe a product of a particularly weak bottom half of the East, but I think they're plucky, and they'll play tough. That's kind of the identity here, which is you know, New York Knicks basketball, right?
Yeah, I think they got harder to play against offensively because they're actually going to be able to be creative and space the floor and shoot now. Going out and getting Evan Fournier, going out and getting, you know, re-signing Derrick Rose, and going out and re-signing Alec Burks. These guys make them harder to play against, and hopefully quickly
takes
away.
Even Kemba, Kemba hasn't looked like Kemba in a while, but he's still like a very solid high volume 3-point shooter, and like at the price they got him, if that's even like 70% of Kemba, that's awesome.
Yeah, totally. So they got harder to play against offensively, which is the thing that they desperately needed, and they still have a lot of the same pieces that made them very difficult to play against defensively. Like, RJ Barrett was a really good defender last year. I know
sure
that
was.
You know, the analytics say he was not a great defender. He was really good last year on the defensive end, I thought. You know, obviously getting 48 minutes of really high-level rim protection from Nerlens Noel and Mitch Robinson for a large portion of the season, that was huge for the Knicks. They were really good. Julius Randle is big for a four-man and can move his feet and can do some different stuff. Taj Gibson was really effective defensively. Like, they have guys that are good defensively. They did lose Reggie Bullock, and if it was me, I would have kept Reggie Bullock over Alec Burks at the price tags that they each signed for, but you know what, you know, that's kind of parsing a little bit, I think. And you know, on top of that, they go out and they get Quentin Grimes and Miles McBride and Jericho Sims, all three of whom I think are genuine plus defenders and project as genuine plus defenders in the NBA. So yeah, I like this offseason from the Knicks. I think they did about as well as you would think.
Yeah, you had Sims like at the near the top of your pick and roll defense bigs, right? When you
did
the subcategory rankings. Yeah. Potential G League blocks leader. Westchester Knicks defense is going to be unbelievable with if McBride and Sims spend time down there.
Yeah, they are. And you would think that they're going to, given the fact that Nerlens Noel and Mitch Robinson
are getting
at center and Miles McBride and
minutes, I mean.
Yeah, they're just not getting minutes. It's going to be tough. So, yeah. I like this Knicks offseason. It's one of those things where they might have a worse record than what they did last year, if only because of the factors, like you said, the East got better and, you know, we might see some shooting regression and things like that. But they're a better team next year, I think. I think they're going to be harder to play against, for sure.
For sure. And I think, you know, this is when the East is as tight as it is, and now that we have the play-in tournament, like, those differences in the regular season, you know, really do matter, like where you stack up in the East. So that's not to say that it's, you know, it won't be a challenge for them to slide in terms of record. But, you know, like you said, this is a team that would be a much harder out in a play-in game than they were last year, or in the first round of the playoffs, like they were last year. I think they're probably around a 500 team, which I know Knicks fans coming off a 41-31 season probably think is pessimistic, but, you know, if you're a 500 team in the East and you're in that play-in mix, like, you can, I mean, and let's be honest, like, the very top teams in the East are playoff-wise an order of magnitude more dangerous than this kind of meaty second tier that a couple of the teams we're talking about are in. So, I think that middle of the East, and even in the Atlantic Division, where three of these teams reside, is going to be a lot of fun this year.
I
keep coming back to certain things being fun. Turns out, Sam, I really like our job, and basketball is awesome. So,
and this year particularly, like, basketball is going to be so fun this year, as long as these guys, like, get some rest, and, you know, this is the last year of this, like, 3-year stretch where it's going to be insane, where they get, like, a shortened off season again. And I just hope that everyone, you know, can continue to stay healthy. But between the influx of talent this off with the draft and guys continuing to get better from the last few draft classes that have been pretty good, it's a great time to be an NBA fan. It's a genuinely great time to write about basketball and just to watch the NBA in general.
For sure. And so while I apologize for resorting to my big takeaway on every team being that they're going to be fun, the Atlantic Division has like 5 teams who could reasonably claim that they're going to be 500 or better and make the playoffs. And that's awesome. So
let's move to the team that was the best, you know, in this division last year, the Philadelphia 76ers. They won the Eastern Conference last year. They had the third best record in the NBA. And it feels weird, like, the position that they're in right now. So let's just kind of run through their moves. They signed Joel Embiid today to a 4-year, $196 million extension. They re-signed Danny Green to a 2-year, $20 million deal. They signed George Niang to a 2-year, $6.7 million deal. They signed Furkan Korkmaz to a 3-year, $15 million deal. They brought in Andre Drummond to replace Dwight Howard on the minimum. They waived George Hill, and they drafted Jaden Springer, Charles Bassey, and Filip Petrushev. Springer is signed. Petrushev is going to be stashing with Efes this year over in Turkey. And then nobody really knows what's happening with Charles Bassey. I'm very unclear right now on that whole situation, but we'll see.
Yeah, so what's the deal with Bassey? Is that a potential, like, domestic stash, or Delaware kind of thing? Or
he held out of summer league for contract reasons. So I think that they're probably negotiating, but I think that they have one two-way filled right now with Rajon Tucker. I don't, and they have another two-way filled. With Aaron Henry. Right? Yeah. So I don't know. Like, frankly, like,
I don't think they have a roster spot.
Yeah. So again, like, this comes down to, like, agents doing the right thing and, like, being smart about the draft process late in the second round. Like, it's better for you to tell Philadelphia, look, do not draft our guy. We're going to take the qualifying offer, and you will have to cut him in training camp, and you'll lose him for nothing. If I was Charles Bassey and the 76ers were playing hardball, I would just sign the qualifying offer, much like I believe J.P. Tokido did at the end of the year.
KJ McDaniels did.
Yeah, that's more of a success story than what I think Charles Bassey.
Yeah, because he got 3 years, $10 million as RFA.
Right. And like played a role on that team as well. Like Charles Bassey
won. And Philly play a role. And Philly flipped them for multiple second round picks. So it worked out for everyone.
Yeah. So the Bassey one, I don't know, man.
Here's what the 76ers do, man, is they trade Paul Reed into one of the small traded player exceptions that the Raptors have. And then they can just sign Charles Bassey and they save like $600K under the tax sheet.
You wouldn't even need to use one of the exceptions because a minimum, right?
So the Raptors have a couple minimum traded player exceptions. I would like those exceptions that aren't really exceptions for anything, but
right.
Are Paul Reed's exact salary. So
yeah, Paul Reed's good. Hot take.
So we're going to go, I mean, I know they're not in the finals as we record this, so he's probably going to be robbed of Summer League MVP, but we were close to Paul Reed stacking a Summer League MVP on top of a G League MVP.
I don't know about that. He was good, but like Peyton Pritchard was way better. Like,
They're in the finals.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. Like Aaron, I don't know. I thought there were a few guys that were better this year at Summer League, but Paul Reed, I kind of wrote that though yesterday, that Paul Reed, is clearly been incredibly productive at Summer League. He was the G League MVP last year. Like, it's just very obvious that he's better than that level. Now we need to see what he can be at the NBA level. I don't really know what the answer to that is. Do you?
I don't. I just brought up Peyton Pritchard's stats in front of me, and this is not including tonight's game. I did not, like, I knew he was having a good tournament. The 15 of 26 on threes is remarkable.
But that's not even the best one. That's not even the best number. The best number is the 8.7 to 1.3 assist to turnover ratio.
Oh, man. That's great.
It's laughable.
That's great.
And by the way, like Davion Mitchell, because I have this game on in the background, Davion Mitchell is putting the shackles on that dude right now. Making his life miserable as we watch this game. So
It is over my left shoulder, so I have to keep turning around to look at it. And I have not been very effective at finding windows to do that, so I'll have to zoom through it again later.
Oh, what a disaster. But the Sixers, with Paul Reed, this offseason feels incomplete. You know what I mean? We don't know what they're doing with Ben Simmons. Once that happens, this will change in some regard.
Yeah, and it makes them a hard team to evaluate, right? Because like a lot of the reporting has suggested that the relationship's pretty fractured to where it would be uncomfortable if Ben Simmons is with this team when the season starts. At the same time, everything we've heard, or at least I've heard, and the chatter in Vegas remain that the asking price is really high on Ben Simmons. And, you know, I got dragged into a little bit of this because the Raptors were tied to him and the prices getting kicked around then were just like made no sense at all.
Right.
So this is a weird thing where like, yeah, I mean, the 76ers roster is like fairly run it back. And you add Niang, you add, Jaden Springer, who maybe doesn't have a path to playing time, but who I really like for them and think they've had, you know, a couple pretty good drafts in a row here. Drummond at the minimum is a lot nicer than Drummond at like $30 million or whatever he was making last year. And I think he's better than Dwight Howard at this stage. It's a pretty good, it's a fine offseason from a pure run it back perspective. And you won 49 games in a 72-game season last year. But it's really hard to figure anything out until we know what's up with the Simmons situation.
Yeah, my concern about the Drummond thing is that Doc Rivers will play him.
if he starts playing minutes with Joel Embiid, that's we're going to be in trouble there, but
That's a deal, too, where it depends on the Simmons deal as well, because if it was me, I would just play Ben Simmons at the five and do that when Joel Embiid is off the court for at least 10 minutes a game. And I would play Andre Drummond like 5 to 8 minutes a game. But
I'd one up you and I'd play Paul Reed in those Andre Drummond minutes just to see what's there.
I think I would, too. cone of silence again. I think I would, too. But
like, look, Drummond is probably better right now, but I'm not 100% sure. And if you're looking at like the window of like, or if we're just looking at like what would move the needle for the 76ers, it's not Andre Drummond giving them 15 good minutes at the minimum. It's Paul Reed suddenly being an NBA player.
Right.
So
Yeah, we'll see what happens with the Sixers. I don't really want to spend too much time on them because it just feels incomplete right now. Like,
yeah,
are they better or worse than last year? Probably about the same. Like, I like the George Niang signing, but I don't think he's like pushing the needle forward in a substantial way for them.
No, I mean, like, he'll probably be better this year than Mike Scott was last year.
Yep.
So that's a nice, like, at the margins upgrade. But yeah, like, they didn't hand their essay in on time. Like, we don't, how are we supposed to evaluate a team that could, like, fundamentally change not only them, but themselves, but, like, the rest of the league between now and the end of October?
Yeah, we'll see. Good for Daryl Morey for continuing to value Ben Simmons in the way that he should be valued, frankly. Like, he should be valued as an incredibly high-level asset. But I don't know. Like, it's, we just don't have an answer yet at the end of the day.
Yeah, so, I'm certainly not going to advocate selling low on guys just to make a deal. But,
right.
Yeah, it's the situation's getting pretty awkward.
Okay, let's take another quick commercial break, and we'll be back to finish up with Toronto. All right, Blake, your dear, sweet Toronto Raptors. Let me just run through the transaction list. They acquired Precious Achiuwa and Goran Dragic in a sign-and-trade for Kyle Lowry, along with a second-round pick, right, Blake?
No.
No, just the players? Okay.
Yeah, unfortunately, I was very surprised. And, like, it was weird because the reporting on that was obviously a little all over the place and up in the air until, like, the team releases. And, like, I wasn't sure as of, like, Friday morning of like, moratorium day. And, like, it didn't seem like other people were sure also if a second was coming back or not. So that was a very awkward situation.
They signed Gary Trent to a 3-year, $52 million deal. Trent has a player option on that last deal, or that last year. They signed Kem Birch to a 3-year, $20 million deal. And I believe Kem Birch also has a player option on that last
deal? No, that's a straight deal.
Oh, just that's a straight
no,
deal?
No options, no partials. Just, yeah, 320 and change.
Sure. They signed Ish Wainwright. I don't know the protections on this, do you?
Yes, I do, actually. Give me one second. I have them in a spreadsheet somewhere. So Ish has 250 this year guaranteed and 125 guaranteed on next year's.
Sam Decker?
Yeah, Decker's got 350 guaranteed.
Okay, and Isak Bonga?
200,000 guaranteed.
So they went with the small guarantee strategy, which is something that I think more teams should be willing to do in order to get high-level free agents.
Yeah, and they have Watanabe held over on a 375 guarantee, too. So could be a really, really spicy camp competition there.
Yeah, I love that. They waived Aaron Baines, DeAndre Bembry, Paul Watson, and Rodney Hood. And they drafted Scotty Barnes, Delano Banton, and David Johnson. I hate everything about this offseason, Blake. I just got to be honest. Like, from getting Gary Trent on a 3-year, $52 million deal that only has 2 years guaranteed before he can be an unrestricted free agent, to signing Kem Birch to a 3-year deal that I don't really, like, I don't know who the competition was for Kem Birch at that price point, to drafting Scotty Barnes over Jalen Suggs, which will never not be completely nonsensical to me. I just don't, like, I don't blame them for the Kyle Lowry thing. Like, I thought that was fine. They could have gone the cap space route when Kyle Lowry left. I don't know who was going to be willing to sign with Toronto, given that they're in this weird limbo situation, just as an organization where we think they're going to be back in Toronto next year, but, like, we're not 100% sure, right?
Yeah, I mean, we're getting really close to 100%. MLSE released their, like, what the protocols and guidelines will be today. So that's... you know, we're very close. The sense I got in Vegas was the team's just waiting for, like, the final thumbs up before they say, hey, give us your money.
Right.
But, you know, like, we're talking on Tuesday night right now in Eastern time, and Wednesday Masai Ujiri has a press conference scheduled. So, like, I wouldn't be surprised if tomorrow they're like, hey, we're back. So,
yeah, and like the thing with that that's worth saying is too that at the start of free agency there wasn't that certainty necessarily,
right?
So
and like that that colored, yeah, it colored some things, and it colored, I think it even colored how they kind of approached this offseason ahead of time. And what I mean by that is like, they very clearly orchestrated the Ken Birch thing as like an extended tryout post buyout. And like the Raptors front office has a really good relationship with the Magic front office. I'm sure that that's something that was, you know, that it wasn't a surprise, let's say, that Ken Birch got bought out, landed with Toronto, and then re-signed in Toronto on a new deal. So, and then I think they would tell you that the Powell for Trent deal was basically like an early, you know, you could look at that as a free agent play, losing Powell in free agency and using the cap space you could have had on Gary Trent. You know, now functionally, that's not a good explanation because part of the draw with Trent was he had such a small cap hold that you could have still created space and then
right.
re-signed him after the fact. But I think they'll look at it as, look, he's slightly cheaper than Powell. He's 2 years fewer than Powell in terms of commitment. He's on his pre-peak phase instead of mid to late peak phase. But I'm with you, man. Like where was Gary Trent getting that player-friendly a deal where he's got 3 years, 51.8, and possibly another 750K in unlikely incentives with the player option? Like maybe well, Trent's camp wanted 4 years and the Raptors were like, well, we'll go three, but we'll let you player option it. But like what the player option does to me is I don't think there's a path to Trent at 22 or 23 as a high volume 40% 3-point shooter being like a huge negative asset. But there is no room for surplus value on this deal.
I don't think I disagree with that, to be honest. Like I think
the surplus part or the bad deal part?
The surplus part. Like, I think he actually could be, like, a pretty real high-end asset. Like, if he is...
But, like, within the next 2 years, you think he could become an $18 million player?
I kind of do think there is a pathway to it, but...
I probably have him for, like, 10 or 12 this coming year. Like, just as a guy who shoots well and shoots a lot, but doesn't have a lot of, like... I mean, almost next to no secondary playmaking skill and... a little juice to his self-creation game, but the defense kind of underwhelmed in Toronto.
I think he's pretty good on defense, to be honest.
He did not have a great 20 games or so with the Raptors on that end, but you know maybe that's the situation change and the scheme change and everything.
Yeah, I mean, like he's physical at the point of attack. He's strong. He can deal with like twos, threes, and fours because of that strength. He's not like a difference-making defender, but I think he's a plus defender within scheme.
Yeah. I mean, look, he's also going to be their worst defender if he starts, right? Like you can if that's the guy that you're putting on the lesser offensive player or hiding or whatever, you're in really good shape.
Yeah, I agree. It's hard to find guys that shoot 40% from three, average 15 points a game because they can do it off of movement and relocation and don't give anything away defensively. Like, yeah. that's actually a really, really hard thing to find in the NBA right now.
For sure. And that's why, I'd probably have him around, you know, $12 million or whatever. It's just the secondary, like, basically where I'm at is, like, he wasn't close to an $18 million player this past year, even with those things going on. You know, I mean, I wasn't as negative.
I'll say he's definitely above 10 to 12 million. Like Doug McDermott just got 14 million. He's better than Doug McDermott.
Yeah. Like, and like, you know, maybe I'm anchored to Hollinger's boards a little bit here where Hollinger had him down at like 7 or 8 million or something like that.
Yeah. That's crazy to me. That's absolutely,
I guess my issue is just that like, even if he becomes who both of us, I think he could be, you know, then he opts out and you're paying the freight on that improvement.
Right.
So I guess that's my issue is that like when I say that he maybe can't return positive value, it's because within a 2 year window, you got to pay the upcharge on any improvement that he has. So
see that I agree with. I do agree that he is probably not going to return positive value for the Raptors on this deal because even if he does do well and hits that $18 million a year mark, or I think it's like 16 and a half or whatever through the first 2 years, right? 16 and a half to 17.
Yeah, it's 16 and then 17.3.
So. Right. So even if he does hit that mark, he's then going to be able to opt out and leave because he'll be unrestricted at that point. I can't really wrap my head around that contract being signed. That's the kind of contract that gets signed whenever Gary Trent is soliciting restricted free agent offers from another team who is trying to steal Gary Trent from the Raptors. That's not a deal that you sign when you're just signing a guy back to an incumbent contract.
Yeah, and it's like, and maybe in isolation, it's justifiable or you can get your head to it, but like the fact that they kind of did the same thing with Kem Birch in a just like, who are you bidding against? 3 years, $20 million for Kem Birch. Like Kem's a good player, and I think that like having him on like it's not gonna be a terrible deal, but like who was offering him more than the room exception? That you had to go a third year fully guaranteed and go, you know, two-thirds of your mid-level. So, you know, I think the Raptors historically have shown that they don't really care to negotiate that hard at the margins. Like they gave OG and Fred VanVleet player options, and they gave Pascal Siakam the 28% kicker even before he was in RFA. Like, they gave it to him a year in advance, and they've, you know, they gave Stanley Johnson a player option, like, they don't seem like they prioritize, you know, winning the deals with their own guys like that. And I can understand it as like, the cultural side and the like, hey, we believe in you. This is what we value you at. And here's your offer. You know, that's probably pretty nice if you're a player to have a negotiation go that way. But in pure, like, you know, the opportunity cost of what they could have done this offseason and moving forward, the opportunity cost of those guys taking up $24 million next year as your young guys are getting more expensive and maybe you're pushing up against the tax, you know, there was probably some room to save a couple mil between those guys.
Yeah, I don't really get the contract structure thing. And then on top of it, I've litigated the Scottie Barnes over Jalen Suggs thing enough. I don't really need to do it again, other than just to note that I think it was silly. I think that they overthought it. It fits everything they look for from players in terms of length and athleticism and great human being. Like, Scottie Barnes, unreal human being. Like, all of that stuff fits. He's just a worse player than Jalen Suggs, is kind of what it comes down to.
Yeah, and, you know, this is something that I took some heat for in the draft process. I tried to prime people for this, that this was a possibility. Like, I took them in our staff mock, and people were pretty fired up. And, you know, it wasn't that I like Scottie Barnes better than Jalen Suggs. It was that I think the Raptors saw the tiers differently than kind of we did as a collective public. You know, whether that was the tier drop off was after three or if it was after five or however it shook out, you know, and Shams had it out there, and I certainly haven't heard anything to the contrary that like they wanted Mobley and they tried to move up, and that, you know, the price there was really prohibitive. So
yeah, I wrote that as well. That was the guy that I was told they wanted Mobley.
Yeah. And with good reason. Like, he's gonna be awesome. I really like Evan Mobley. I think Barnes is gonna be like he's gonna be a fan favorite and he's gonna do some cool stuff, and I think he's gonna be an excellent defender. But yeah, like the overthinking part or the like, you know, did you misplay the hand not finding a trade down opportunity? You know, maybe the Magic take him on you and it's a moot point. But yeah, I don't know. I've come to terms with the Scottie Barnes thing. Like, I don't want to sit here and be like, oh, I would have taken Scottie Barnes over Jalen Suggs, because I don't think I would have if I was in that position. But I've done enough thinking on it and trying to figure out their logic that, like, I'm at peace with it. It's time to move forward, I guess. And it'll only be in my mentions 82 times this year when Jalen Suggs puts up 15 or 20 and makes all rookie and all that stuff.
Yeah. Look, I think this team is probably going to have a better record than what they did last year, if only because last year, just a number of things went wrong for Toronto.
Literally all of them.
Right. Like, I think they will win more than, what did they win, like 38% of their games or something like that?
Yeah, they were 27-45, whatever that works out to.
Yeah, like, I think they will win a higher percentage than 38-40% of their games, but yeah. I don't see this as a playoff team, I'm going to be honest. Like, maybe they're like the 10th seed in the play-in tournament. Like, I think they're going to be fighting with Washington and Charlotte and all of those teams to get into the play-in tournament.
So here's where I'm at on that, and it's tough because some of the factors they dealt with last year are difficult to quantify, right? So the not being at home all year is obviously a thing. Every player on their team missed at least 11 games, which is kind of crazy. They had three starters miss 5+ games with COVID, like actually with COVID, as well as Malachi Flynn and Paul Watson, who were, you know, the guys who could have stepped into that role. And Siakam and Van Vliet at least both talked openly, similar to Jason Tatum and Evan Fournier and a couple other guys, about the toll that they felt from that well after they returned. You also have, you know, the coaching staff gets wiped out with it. And then, you know, if we're being honest, once things went south, they really leaned into being okay with lottery odds. They did not play guys much over the final month of the season or so. And part of the reason is that they started winning again accidentally. And even though they were not playing their best lineups and stuff and had dealt with all this, you know, they went on a 4-game winning streak in the middle of April. And suddenly it was like, shit, are we too close to the play-in game when we want lottery odds? So all of that stuff happened, and they still had to lean in a little bit to losing. So I think they'll be in that play-in mix, that kind of 7-10 range. You know, far be it for me to ever bet against the constantly beating their Vegas over-under Raptors 9 years in a row up until last year. Everyone on their team, other than Goran Dragic, is either in peak phase or in kind of the development or pre-peak phase of their development curve still. So there's some upside there potentially. And I think the team will be, you know, pretty feisty defensively, certainly better than the 15th they finished in defensive rating last year.
Yeah, they'll be a top 10 defensive team this year, I think.
Yeah. They will not be a top 10 offensive team, I don't think, though, is the
that's where I'm worried. Issue here.
At least not in the half court. Like, maybe they get back to being a transition juggernaut, and part of that's like, you know, their defense has been pretty established for a couple years now as the highest turnover forcing defense, and that fuels the transition game for easy buckets. But the half court's going to be a slog. So I don't know. I think they're, depending on what we call a playoff team now with the play-in games, like, I think they're in the play-in games at least. But, you know, you're going to need some growth from some guys to, if they're going to jump into the kind of six range or something like that.
Yeah, I think that losing Kyle Lowry is like a big deal. Like, we haven't really talked about it.
Yeah,
Kyle Lowry still played like 50 games last year and was
good. And it's tough because like we didn't see him after that Lakers performance. But yeah, he was still putting up like 17-5-7, like pretty efficiently, and was their best 3-point shooter and is the best. Like, everyone's job gets so much easier when Kyle Lowry's on the floor. And I think from like an off court and kind of, you know, general leadership perspective, Fred VanVleet's ready for a lot of that. I don't think he has the same level of, I can make everyone around me significantly better. Like, maybe a little bit better, sure. He improved as a pick and roll passer last year and had some good chemistry with their bigs when, you know, they played functional ones. But yeah, you don't have like I don't think anyone on this team is dragging Malcolm Miller, Terrence Davis, Rondae Hollis-Jefferson, and Chris Boucher to a 30-point comeback.
Yeah, like Kyle Lowry, like essentially replacing Kyle Lowry with Goran Dragic, maybe. Like, look, Goran Dragic is on the roster, and you have reported that the Raptors are going to hold him until they find something suitable or just play him, right? They're replacing Kyle Lowry with Goran Dragic, Precious Achiuwa, and basically Scottie Barnes. Kyle Lowry is better than those guys. Like, Kyle Lowry will give them more value than that trio.
Yeah, definitely. Like Kyle Lowry's Kyle Lowry. I don't know how much more to say about it. Like, and he's, you know, at 35, he was still really, really good. So, I think that's a real factor, and I think you know, the Raptors are banking on a little bit, the guys growing into those roles a little bit more. But yeah, I mean, like, would it be terribly surprising if they underperform just a little bit and they're like, ah, what's one more lottery pick to add to the mix? Like, no, it wouldn't be that surprising. I just don't think that's going to be plan A. Like, I think they think with Siakam, VanVleet, and Anunoby as their core, and the way they've added some youth around that, I think they think they can get back to that kind of like 2017-ish spot.
Yeah, I'm a bit skeptical. Probably a better team than last year, if only because things went so horribly wrong.
How could they not be? Yeah,
but I don't know if I'm like super positive on them either. Blake,
we also like, sorry, we talked about the Ben Simmons incomplete thing, and like the Dragic thing might not resolve to the deadline, but like,
yeah,
part of the Kyle Lowry deal is not completed yet. Like, I don't think anyone expects Dragic in Toronto past the deadline. So yeah, there's another tweak to be made there too. So, and I don't know if that happens before the season starts or if they like let him be a rotation piece and move him at the deadline or whatever. But worth saying too that like there's another shoe to drop there or a domino to fall or whatever. Whatever the yeah, thing is. I'm not good with my sayings today, Sam.
I mentioned on the Southwest podcast that I recorded with Danny LaRue that came out earlier this week. The numbers work on a Dwight Powell and Moses Brown for Goran Dragic deal.
Yeah. And which can't happen until October 1st?
Yes.
Is that,
so,
is that right?
Yeah. You can't aggregate you can't aggregate Moses Brown until then. So yeah. That makes sense to me. I think it makes sense for everyone. Dwight Powell's Canadian. They could use another center option. Goran Dragic, you know, I think would be much happier in Dallas, let's say, playing next to Luka Doncic. That deal just makes a lot of sense for everyone involved. Whether or not either team decides to go that road, we will see. But yeah, that's kind of where I sit on this. That's the like wide open, easy just deal that continues to like pop up for me in my brain.
Yeah, and you know, if I'm the Raptors, I think I'd probably rather have that deal done, you know, in training camp when it's allowed. But also, like, they have Dwight Powell and Ken Burch and Precious and Moses Brown, and I don't know, they don't overthink it, like get the guys you want or whatever. I could see them asking for a little bit more back just because Dwight Powell is owed money next year too. But
sure.
That's the general framework, I think, is what we're getting at here. Like, Dwight Powell plus for Goran Dragic still is the likeliest thing to happen, I think.
Yeah, I agree. Blake, tell the people where they can find your work. Tell the people what's going on.
Yeah, they can find my work at The Athletic on the Raptors side. Lots of summer league stuff if you are interested in that kind of thing. I have a couple, you know, features pocketed from my summer league work that'll be out over the next couple weeks. I think a fun look at some of the newer Raptors. That's about it.
Yeah, I will be on vacation by the time this podcast comes out. So
hell yeah.
Yeah, very excited about that. So whatever you think of this, please feel free to tweet me. I might not respond, but please feel free to tweet at me and yell at us for our opinions on the Atlantic Division, which is always, it always feels like an arms race, right, Blake? Like these teams,
well, these fan bases all really dislike each other when the teams are good. And then like there's the quick pivot to commiserating together when they're bad. So yeah, like this will come out and all five fan bases are going to be mad at us. And then, you know, we'll be right about maybe three of the teams and then it'll just be two teams that hate us.
All right. This has been the Game Theory Podcast. Please remember, rate, review, subscribe, do everything you can to support the show. We'll be back next week with more off-season breakdowns. But until next time, we'll talk soon. Bye.